Kara looked at me, and as she held out her hand, I was surprised to find a smile on her face, considering the circumstances, and she said to me, "This is how I know I'm a mom." It was a Thursday night, and as is often the case around our house on Thursday nights, Kara and Penny went over to Peoria so she could have her violin lesson, which meant I had the boys for the evening. And so we did what we normally do. We went on a walk, and we watched shows on TV, and we built Legos together, and we had a great night. But I tell you what, the moment that back door cracked open, he could hear it. Felix could hear it, and Felix ran to Mom. "Mom, Mom, Mom," he said. And he wrapped his arms around her leg, and she picked him up. And being a mom, of course, she picked up on stuff I don't pick up on. Because she took one look at him, and she said, "Felix, do you feel?" And that's when he started to throw up on her. And you know, being a great mom, she was quick. She was like, got him turned around, and then he's throwing up in the sink, but he's also throwing up down the front of himself and throwing up down the front of her, and you know, and then she takes him and she runs him into the bathroom and she strips him down and gets him in the tub. And again, this is all like within 30 seconds of walking in the door. And I'm just kind of in shock. And I walk in to check on how they're doing, and she turns and she looks at me and she holds out her hand. And there is still vomit in her hand and all over her arm. And she looks at me and she says, "The fact that I am not throwing up right now, this is how I know I'm a mom." And you know, there's a lot of truth in that. And those of you that have been through that, I'm sure, can identify. But I share that because it reflects this idea for us this morning that the way we respond in the midst of adversity says a lot about who we are, right? The way we respond, but when things get hard, when life throws surprises at us that we're not ready for, we're not expecting, it says a lot about who we are and what's going on inside of us. The way we respond when there's struggles in our marriage, the way we respond when the doctor says he doesn't really quite know what the problem with our heart may be, the way we respond when we find out that we are failing that class in school, the way we respond in the midst of that adversity, it says a lot about who we are. And hopefully, the way we respond is going to say that we are people after God's own heart. We want to respond to adversity as believers, as Christians. And so we're going to be looking together today in 1 Samuel chapter 30. That's 1 Samuel chapter 30, as David himself responds in the midst of adversity. And he will respond as a man, truly as a king, after God's own heart. And from that, we're going to take three basic ideas for ourselves about how we can respond in the midst of adversity. We're going to be picking up together this morning again in 1 Samuel chapter 30, starting right there in verse 1. And as we begin, we're going to see that this first thing, that people after God's own heart find strength in Him in the midst of adversity. People after God's own heart find strength in Him, find strength in God in the midst of adversity. We see this in verses 1 to 8. As we begin, we're told in verse 1 that David and his men reached Ziklag on the third day. Let me give you a quick reminder of where we are at historically. So David and his men, they were living in Ziklag at that time. That's where they were with their families. But Ziklag is not in Israel per se. It was actually in occupied Philistine territory. How did David and a bunch of mercenary men get the rights to live in occupied Philistine territory? Well, they made a deal with the Philistine king. That they told him that they would serve as mercenaries for him. And they were attacking to the nations and people south of them, but they would bring the loot and plunder back. They would tell the Philistine king that it was from the Hebrew people that they were raiding, and He bought the lie hook, line, and sinker. In fact, he bought it so much that when the Philistines went off to war against Israel in the north, he told David and his men that they were going to come and fight with him. They were going to fight with the Philistine forces. And last week, David and his men found themselves between a rock and a hard place. If they admitted that they'd been lying, the Philistine forces would have killed them. But if they went to war, they were going to be forced to kill their fellow Hebrews, and that wasn't right either. And thankfully, mercifully, not just luckily, God opened a way for them to return home. In fact, they were forcefully commanded to take their men and leave in peace and return home. And so we pick up with them. Now, 3 days later, with that huge weight off their chest, returning from the front, excited to go home, to be greeted by their wives, to be greeted by their kids who are going to run up and give them that big hug when they return home, to have a night sleeping in their own bed. But what they find is an adversity that they had never expected. What they find when they return home is ash and ruins. Now, the Amalekites had raided the Negev and Ziklag. They had attacked Ziklag and burned it, and taken captive the women and all who were in it, both young and old. They killed none of them, but carried them off as they went on their way. They expect to come home to that warm welcome, and instead they find the warm, smoldering ruins of their home. They don't know that it was the Amalekites quite yet at this time, although we're revealed that in the text. It's probably with great trepidation that they enter their former homes, afraid of what they might find, but there are no bodies. It means that their wives and children have been taken captive instead, but that doesn't exactly mean things are great for them. This is a time when human trafficking is alive and well. Their families are going to likely be hauled down to Egypt, where they will be sold into slavery. When David and his men came to Ziklag, they found it destroyed by fire, their wives and sons and daughters taken captive. And David is most certainly not immune to this adversity. David and his men wept until they had no strength left to weep. These men are hardened warriors. These are men that have been through countless battles. These are men that have faced challenges and adversity like we will never know. But to them, nothing compares to come home and to find their homes gone and their families taken. These grown men, these warriors, they weep openly. And we're told they weep until they have no strength left in them. This is how bad it is. And David is with them. David's two wives had been captured, Ahinoam of Jezreel and Abigail, the widow of Nabal of Carmel. And David is greatly distressed, we're told. And David's not just greatly distressed because of his own loss and sense of mourning in what's happened. David is greatly distressed because the men were talking of stoning him. Each one was bitter in spirit because of his sons and daughters. David is mourning himself. But David has an even more eminent problem that he has to struggle with, and that's the fact that the men are considering stoning David for this. And not just like David can see it in their eyes that they're upset, we're told in the text, they are actively speaking out loud to each other about how they're going to go about killing David for this. Their hearts are filled with bitterness. They're angry, they're upset, and they are looking for someone to blame. They don't know who's taken their families at this time. They don't know what's become of them or whether they'll find them again, but they're looking for something to do with all of that struggle in their hearts, and we're told they give into bitterness. And they're looking for someone to take it out on, and David is the nearest person that they can think of. We followed you. We trusted you. You said that you were doing what God wanted us to do, and now we end up in this. They're ready to pick up those smoldering pieces of their homes and use them to beat the life out of David. But, we're told, but David found strength in the Lord his God. David found strength in the Lord his God. In the midst of adversity, many of those that were following him, we're told, they give in to that bitterness. They give in to hopelessness. They were looking to take their anger and frustration out on someone else. But David, in contrast, David, a man after God's own heart, he found his strength in the Lord. He would trust the Lord. He would turn to the Lord. He knew that the Lord would be with him even in the midst of this adversity. And so quickly, David said to Abiathar the priest, the son of Ahimelech, "Bring me the ephod." Abiathar brought it to him, and David inquired of the Lord, "Shall I pursue this raiding party? Will I overtake them?" "Pursue them," he answered. "You will certainly overtake them and succeed in the rescue." Before they can start picking up stones, David calls Abiathar. Abiathar is the priest that is with them, their chaplain, if you will, of this military band. And he also happens to be one of the line of the high priests at that time, and means he has the ephod. This is a priestly garment that they would wear, and as part of it, there is a way that they can discern the will of the Lord, yes or no questions. And so he asks of the Lord, you know, should we pursue this raiding party? The answer is yes. Will we overtake them and succeed? The answer is yes as well. But I want us to note something here, because it's easy to get these things out of order. It's not that when David finds out things are going to turn out well, that then he finds strength in the Lord. As if the positive outcome is what gives him the strength. Before David ever knows how things are going to turn out, David is still finding strength in the Lord. Even before he knows that they will succeed on their journey. Those that are after God's own heart, people that are after God's own heart, in the midst of adversity, they find strength in the Lord. Sometimes, we just want to find someone to blame, right? I mean, when you've got those struggles in your marriage, isn't it always so easy to blame your spouse? Well, if he had done this, if she had done this, it's all their fault. And all of a sudden, we're taking our frustrations out on the person that we should love more than anybody in the world save God himself. Sometimes we give in and give up hope in the midst of adversity. The doctor says, "I don't really know what's going on with your heart." And we can say, it's hopeless. There's no options. I Googled it, and that was a mistake. You know, there's like 100 different things that it could be, and nobody knows, and nobody can say what it's going to be, and we want to give up all hope together in the face of that adversity. Sometimes we want to paint ourselves as victims. We want to become the victim in the midst of adversity. When you find out that you're failing that class, it's the teacher's fault. They're too hard. If I had that other professor, I heard that they give multiple choice tests for them. And so if I had that person, then my grade would be better. If I had taken it, in the spring instead of the fall, it's not my fault. If they did a better job teaching it, we make ourselves victims. And again, we're it's always the world's fault, someone else's fault, not anything we would have done. But because we are believers, because we are Christian, shouldn't we believe that God is in control, that God is sovereign in all things, and to find strength in him even in the midst of adversity, when we're struggling in our marriage, when the doctor doesn't know exactly what's going on, when we've got trouble in college or in our classes, in school, we should find our hope and our strength in him. That's how people after God's own heart respond. So that's the first thing that we see from David. The second is this, that people after God's own heart go above and beyond, that they give it their all in the face of adversity. People after God's own heart give it their all in the face of adversity. We We know that God is sovereign. We know that God is in control. But does that mean we should just do nothing and say, well, God will fix that marriage stuff, or I don't need to listen to anybody or talk to anybody. It's hopeless anyways. God will just fix my heart or do what he does. Or God will make that teacher give me good grades and I don't need to change anything. I mean, I think we know that that's not the way it works, right? So yes, we find our strength in the Lord, absolutely. But we also understand that with that strength, God is going to call us into action. And those after God's own heart give it their all. They go above and beyond, as we certainly see David and his men do, picking up in verses 9 to 19. We're told David and the 600 men with him came to Bezor ravine, where some stayed behind, for 200 men were too exhausted to cross the ravine. But David and 400 men continued the pursuit. David and his 600 men, immediately, they go. They don't wait. They don't spend the night and let's start off fresh in the morning. You got to imagine. The moment they found out, they went. And they rode as hard as they could. They rode as fast as they could. These are men that are giving it their all. In fact, for some of the men, it's just too much. Maybe there's some older guys that are in their group, or maybe there's some men that have injuries that they've sustained and they can't travel as quickly. And it soon becomes obvious that about a third of the men are holding them back. And so when they come to Bezor, 200 of the men stay behind with the supplies, and 400 of the men go on. What we're told, and by the way, if you wonder, why don't they just tell those 200 people to catch up with us? Well, remember, they don't know who's taken their families at this point in time, and they don't know where they've gone. And so they can't say, just meet up with us, because who knows where this is going to take them. In all likelihood, they left them in Bezor with the supplies, and they say, well, we're going to go south first, but if we don't find anything, we'll come back, we'll resupply, and we'll go west, or we'll go east. You know, we'll go from there, and without those supplies, they can also travel further, faster, and quicker. They obviously want to give it their all. But eventually, and again, we believe that the Lord's hand is active in this, they found someone. They found an Egyptian in a field and brought him to David. They gave him water to drink, food to eat, part of a cake of pressed figs and two cakes of raisin. This guy's gobbling stuff down. He ate and was revived, for he had not eaten any food or drunk any water for 3 days and nights. It sounds as if they're kind of even spreading out as they're scouting for any hope. And one of the group of men, they find a random Egyptian that's certainly out of place wandering around a field. They're hoping, they're praying that this could be the lead that they need. He's a bit disoriented, distracted. He's obviously dehydrated. He hasn't ate or drank anything in 3 days. But they stop and take the time to nurse this man back to help, hoping, praying that it will give them a lead on how they might pursue their families. As soon as he comes to, David asked him, to whom do you belong? Where do you come from? He said, I am an Egyptian, the slave of an Amalekite. My master abandoned me when I became ill 3 days ago. We raided the Negev of the Kerethites, the territory belonging to Judah, and the Negev of Caleb, and we burned Ziklag. This slave comes to. He likely was not an active participant in the raiding. I say that because David didn't kill him then and there. It was likely a servant that was brought along to help carry the plunder that they hoped to amass. The Amalekites said, hey, if the Israelites are fighting the Philistines up north, guess what? That means their southern borders are completely unprotected. So they went out raiding the south of both nations. When this slave was sick, he couldn't carry the load that they wanted him to. They had no care for him. They cut him loose, left him to die. That's where David and his men found him. And yes, he reveals who they are, Amalekites, and what they've done. And when he said that they'd burned Ziklag, you got to imagine he could tell that something connected with the men. Maybe how they looked at him, maybe the way they frantically started speaking to one another, but When David asked him, "Can you lead me down to this raiding party?" he answered, "Well, swear to me before God that you will not kill me or hand me over to my master, and I will take you to them." He doesn't want them taking that anger out on him either. And so he says, "Swear to me that you won't take my life, and I will lead you to them." They agree to it. And just like that, we're told in verse 16, he led David down, and there they were, scattered over the countryside, eating, drinking, and reveling because of the great amount of plunder they had taken from the land of the Philistines and from Judah. The servant leads them to David and his men, and it's not a neat and orderly war party that they stumble upon. It's a men caught up in drunken revelry and celebration. They're celebrating how smart they were to attack the Israelites and the Philistines while they were distracted. They're celebrating how much they got, how successful they've been. I imagine that then and there, David drew his sword, gritted his teeth, and they ran off in to battle. It's interesting, we're told in verse 17, David fought them from dusk until the evening of the next day. David doesn't wait till morning. He's attacking as the sun is getting ready to set. They're not going to be able to see at night. They're not going to be able to do normal battle tactics. But these aren't men that are thinking, well, let's just wait and take our time. These are men that are seeking to give it everything they have, that want to hold nothing back. And so as the sun is beginning to set, they rush down into battle, and it is going to last for at least a day. But we're told this. None of them got away, except for 400 young men who rode off on camels and fled. These probably rode off immediately. David recovered everything the Amalekites had taken, including his two wives. Nothing was missing, young or old, boy or girl, plunder or anything else that had been taken. David brought everything back. And I think that that's an important note because it's emphasized a couple different ways in our text. David brought everything back. David could have gone down and he and his men could have fought them a little bit, got their wives and children back, and sent the Amalekites running with their tail between their legs. But you notice they didn't do that. They stop, they battle for an entire day, and they make sure that every Amalekite that is there is taken care of so that this does not happen again. And there's something else happening here that it's easy for us to miss, because you see, if you go a little bit further back in 1 Samuel, it was last year, so you'll be forgiven for forgetting it. No, probably 2 years ago that we studied this passage. But God had called Saul to pass judgment on the Amalekites and actually wipe them out then because of their sins against the Hebrew people. And Saul said he did it. In fact, Saul said he did it and then erected a statue in his honor celebrating his great victory. Now, did Saul finish off the Amalekites? No. Saul clearly did just enough to get by. Just enough to be able to say, you know, he'd done most of what God had asked him to do. They clearly seemed alive and well. And so now David, the future king of Israel, is going to seek to do everything he can to finish the job that Saul did half the first time around. Again, we see David as someone who goes above and beyond, who gives it his all, who brings every single thing back that was taken. Sometimes we struggle to give it our all. We usually don't struggle in the midst of adversity to give it all, but long term we struggle. Isn't that what we do? You know, we're struggling in our marriage, and so we say, "Well, we need a date night," or we need to get on a budget because we're struggling a lot financially and that's leading to these clashes. You know, we need to do this. And so you do for like 2 or 3 weeks until the immediate problem has passed, and then you immediately fall back into your old ways of doing things. Isn't that the way it works? When the doctor says, "I don't know exactly what's going on with your heart, but I can tell you that it's not going to hurt anything if you cut down on your salt." I mean, your tests say you've got an unusually large amount of salt in your system. Do you salt everything? And you say, that's none of your business. But you know you need to be better about it. And you've got the heart problem. So what do? You're good about it. Until your first doctor checkup, right? And then you go to the doctor, and he says, whoa, you did really good. And you say, good. And then you get McDonald's on the way back. Because you love those extra salty fries. And you just go back into doing, again, we like to do just enough to get by, don't we? Just enough to feel like we're out of the real big problem. You find out you're failing that class, so what do? Well, you study hard for the next test, or the next quiz, or the next project you have to turn in. And you know what? When you get a B on that, and you realize, hey, you know, with that B, I'm out of failing. I'm in C-minus territory. And you know what? C's get degrees. So you're just going to keep going on like that. We will do just enough to get by so much of the time. But that's not how people after God's own heart respond. We don't say, I've got the strength of the Lord and he's helping me, so I'm going to give the bare minimum. So I'm going to do just enough to get by. Hopefully we have a heart that says, I want to give it my all. I want to do everything I can because I trust that God is doing everything in his power to strengthen me and help me through this, because that's what I've been praying about. That's what I've been talking about. That's what I've been going through with him. People after the Lord seek strength in him, but also give it their all. And when all is said and done, we see the third thing that's so important, and that's that people after the Lord's own heart give him the glory and honor. People after the Lord's own heart give him the glory and honor for seeing them through those times of adversity. We see this with David as we pick up now in verse 20. After everything said and done, we're told David took all the flocks and herds and his men and drove them ahead of the other livestock, saying, this is David's plunder. Then David came to the 200 men who had been too exhausted to follow him and who were left behind at the Bezor ravine. They came out to meet David and the people with him. And as David and his men approached them, he greeted them. David greets them warmly and welcomes them. But all the evil men and troublemakers among David's followers said, No. Because they did not go out with us, we will not share with them the plunder we recovered. Okay, each man may take his wife and children and go. I don't want to take care of your kids, buddy. But the rest of it, that belongs to us. Again, David comes back. He greets the men warmly. But many of the soldiers that went out, they say, No. You don't come out and celebrate. You don't cheer. You don't sing with us. No. The victory is ours. We deserve the glory. We deserve the plunder. Don't think that any of this is yours. You can take your wife and kids, and you can go. Of course, where are they supposed to go? Their home got burned to the ground, don't you remember? And they don't have any possessions left. But that's not how these men are thinking. David has a very different plan, though. David replied, No, my brothers, you must not do that with what the Lord has given us. He has protected us and handed over to us the forces that came against us. Who will listen to what you say? The share of the man who stayed with the supplies is to be the same as that as him who went down to battle. All will share alike. David made this a statute and ordinance for Israel from that day to this. David says, all will share alike. But why does David say all will share alike? It's easy for us to read this passage and say, well, David is a military strategist. He understands that, you know what, a good offense, you're going to need a good supply line. That if you're going to go off to battle, you're going to need people in the back. You're going to need people protecting your supplies. You're going to need the people that are supporting those that are going on the front lines, that all of us are a part of the victory together, even those that were support members, not just those on the front line, so we should all share alike. It makes sense. Again, and when we think of large military conflicts, we can certainly understand that you're going to need medics, you're going to need cooks, and you're going to need people that are supplying those on the front lines. That all makes sense. That's just not what David says here. That is not why David says everybody should share alike. Look with me again at what David does say. He says this, "No, my brothers, you must not do that with what the Lord has given us. He, the Lord, has protected us, and he, the Lord, has handed over to us the forces that came against us." David says that everybody should share alike because the victory and glory belongs to the Lord. And because it belongs to the Lord, everybody can share in what they've recovered. You see, the evil men that came with it, they had a very different perspective. Their perspective was, I fought the battle, I took the risks, I won the day, and because I was the one that was out there, I deserve the plunder, and I deserve the glory. I did the work, I won the day, I get the stuff. Those of you that stayed back, you get nada. That was their attitude. They got the glory, they got the honor, so they got the plunder. David has a very different perspective. David says, the Lord won the day. The Lord is the one that handed them over to us. The Lord is the one that won the victory. So why should anybody get a bigger share of what the Lord has done than anybody else? You see how David has a very different perspective on this? The Lord carried us through, and because the Lord carried us through, these guys don't get more than those guys. The Lord carried all of us through together. And if he's seen fit to give it to us, glory and honor and praise to him. David is giving the glory and honor and the victory to the Lord. This continues as we pick up in verse 26. When David arrived at Ziklag, he sent some of the plunder to the elders of Judah, who were his friends, saying, "Here is a present for you from the plunder of the Lord's enemies." He sent it to those who were in Bethel, Ramoth, Negev, and Jatter, to those who were in Aror, Siphmoth, Estoma, and Rakol, to those in the Jerahmeelites and the Kenites, to those in Hormah, Borazin, Athak, and Hebron, and to those in all the other places where David and his men had roamed. They bring back this plunder, and the truth is the plunder is from all over Judah. And so David takes this plunder, and he gives parts of it back, especially, I believe, to those who were affected by the Amalekites. And as he does, it's worth noting, he doesn't say, "Here is a gift from me, from David. Remember this, if I should need to become king, or if I should need some place to hang out and hide out sometime, remember me. Remember David gave this to you." That's not what he says. He says, "Here is a gift from the Lord's enemies." And the word used here for gift, it's the Hebrew word for blessing. Here is a blessing from the Lord, who brought it from his enemies and has returned it to you. Again, David has, in our opinion, every right to take the glory and honor for himself. But David, a man after God's own heart, sees this very differently. And for him, it's one more opportunity to give glory and honor to God. That's how people after God's own heart respond through those times of adversity. I wonder, do we think to do that? You know, when your friend comes up to you and says, "Wow, you know, the two of you, you have changed so much in the past year. I mean, I wasn't sure you were going to make it a year ago, but now, like, you guys are in love all over again. How did you do it?" Does your answer involve God in any way, shape, or form? Praise the Lord. Now, he really helped us. He drew us together. Or is it all about all the things you did? When you go to the doctor, and he says, "I don't know how to tell you this, but, I mean, that heart issue, I'm not really seeing any signs of it. I don't know what you did." Do you say, "I know what I did. I went on the Google. I found these supplements, and I've been taking them, you know, the last couple months, and they just changed everything for me." Do we mention God at all? Do we give him any glory and honor or praise, or is it all about what we have done? When you finish up that class and the teacher just goes out of the way to say to you, "Wow, you got a B." And I don't mean that in a negative way. I mean, I didn't think you were going to pass. I mean, that is just fantastic. You did so much hard work. I'm so proud of you. You know, is your response going to involve the Lord at all? Or is it going to be all about you. And I don't want to take away from the fact that you probably did hard work and you did buckle down, but do you recognize God's place in that? Are you willing to give him the glory through this as well? Because that's how people after God's own heart respond, because we know we're finding strength in him. And yes, we are going to give it all that we can, but ultimately we know that God is sovereign, that God is in control, that God is at work, and that means when he carries us out the other side, the glory and honor belongs to him. How we respond in the midst of these adversities, whether it's in our home or in our health or at school or whatever else it might be, it says a lot about who we are on the inside. And my hope and prayer is that when that adversity finds you, not if, because it's when, we've been around long enough to know. Maybe it'll be this week or this month or this year or next year, but it's always there. When that comes, will you respond like one after God's own heart? Will you find your strength in him? Will you give it all that you can? And will you make sure to give God glory and honor and praise for his help and strength and support in carrying you through? Would you close with me in prayer? Gracious Heavenly Father, we come before you in prayer, and we want to give you thanks now. Lord, we hope we will live these things out then and in the future, but the truth is all of us here, Lord, have had times in the past year that you have carried us through. Maybe it's times where we were struggling with our kids. Maybe it was struggling, Lord, with something at work. Maybe it was a time of loss and difficulty we faced. Lord, whatever it may be, we know that you gave us the strength to carry through. And so this morning, we take time and we give you glory and we give you honor and we give you thanks. And we ask, Lord, that when that trouble comes in the future, that through your Spirit, Lord, you would help us not to rely on ourselves, but to find strength in you and you alone. We pray these things in the name of your Son, by the power of your Spirit. Amen.